I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Linda Killian talked with voters in four states, Virginia, New Hampshire, Ohio, and Colorado, to gauge their sense of dissatisfaction and disaffection with the current political system for her new book, The Swing Vote. She describes the people she talked with as neither strictly conservative nor liberal and predicts that they will decide the outcome of the 2012 presidential race. While these voters represent a mix of political, social, and economic philosophies, they are united in their distaste for the Republican and Democratic parties. We were intrigued with her findings and asked Linda Killian to join us today on Radio Times. She's a Washington-based journalist, a senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She's also a columnist and political writer for Newsweek, The Daily Beast, The Atlantic, Politics Daily, U.S. News and World Report, and Politico. She was a senior editor for NPR's All Things Considered. And Linda Killian, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. How big a percentage of the population are we talking about when we talk about these swing voters?
Well, 40% of all registered voters are independents, or sometimes they're called unenrolled or undeclared. Every state calls them something different. But they are not members of the Democratic or Republican parties. That's a bigger percentage of registered voters than either the Democratic or Republican parties. Now, of that, so that's 40% have chosen to disaffiliate from the two parties. Of that group, I say, and I've done a lot of research and various polling backs me up on this, and this is a point of contention.
Yes, I
know. Of that 40%, half, roughly about 20% of all registered voters are swing voters, which means they don't regularly identify with either the Republican or Democratic parties. They swing. They mix up their ballot. They vote for candidates of both parties. They vote for independent candidates if they're available. They maybe voted for Ronald Reagan. They voted for Bill Clinton. They voted for George Bush. They voted for Barack Obama. They swing.
But you're also saying that these are people that actually do vote. Even if they're not affiliated with these parties, they do go to the polls to vote.
Well, it changes. Every election is different. For example, turnout in 2010 was down, certainly from 2008. But not all Republican and Democratic voters vote either. So it changes from election to election.
Now, you have some fancy-slash-cute names for these swing voters, as you describe them. Let's begin with the NPR Republicans. Who are these people?
The NPR Republicans would be a natural Romney constituency. He's their man. They are moderate, what we used to call Rockefeller Republicans. They're moderate on social issues. They're well-educated, older, tend to be affluent, but fiscally conservative.
And Romney would probably be their guy? At least.
Yes, you find a lot of them in New England, but you find them all over the country. Traditional, what we have known as country club Republicans.
In fact, you say that Lisa Murkowski of Alaska is probably a good example of she might not like this, but an NPR Republican?
Yeah, she is a little bit more socially conservative. There was just a brouhaha about the birth control vote and something she did. I would say Olympia Snow of Maine, Susan Collins of Maine, Chris Shays of Connecticut, who's running for the Senate now. Those are traditional NPR Republicans.
You also talk about America First Democrats, and these were probably were the Reagan Democrats.
That's right.
Of the
past. That's right. And there's a lot of them in Pennsylvania. Ohio is one of the states I focused on, as you mentioned. There are a lot of similarities between Ohio and Pennsylvania. And these voters, male, lower, middle class, and working class, a lot of, you know, factory workers and people, you know, who are blue collar, they're socially more conservative. They're for a strong defense. They are very concerned about jobs being shipped overseas. A lot of them have seen their jobs shipped overseas. So Barack Obama did not win a majority of their votes in 2008. A lot of them voted for John McCain, but Romney is not a natural for them. You know, we've just seen some recent polling about likability and other factors, and in almost everything except the economy, Barack Obama trumps Mitt Romney. And this group, you know, if you're making comments like Mitt Romney has, that $300,000 he made in speaking fees or chump change, or, you know, that he doesn't care about poor people, or, you know, building elevators for your cars and having money in Swiss and Cayman Island bank accounts, that would not be someone that would naturally appeal to this, to the America First Democrats.
Do you think they have a natural affiliation with a Tea Party candidate?
I think it goes candidate by candidate. In Ohio, for example, in Ohio and Wisconsin, some of the anti-union efforts that took place after the 2010 election have really alienated these voters. I talked to a number of them, a policeman, for example, in Columbus, who's in the book, and he had had a tradition of voting Republican. And after the Ohio effort to take away the collective bargaining rights of public employees, he swore that he wouldn't vote Republican again, and he told me he's working for Barack Obama this time.
Interesting.
So I think the Republicans, and I think Barack Obama knows this, and this is why he's working hard for this demographic. He's gone to a lot of factories. He's talking about manufacturing and tax policy. So I think he knows this group is in play.
You also describe a group that you call the Facebook generation, and I guess these would be, what, younger voters, people under the age of 35?
That's right. That's exactly right. And they are registered as independents in a higher percentage than any other age group. They don't trust either party. They, however, are, they turned out big for Barack Obama in 2008. They're a bit disillusioned by the change that they didn't see that Barack Obama promised, a post-partisan presidency. But they are very socially libertarian. They don't believe the government has any business getting involved in issues like abortion and gay rights and this kind of thing. And so what they told me is they would vote for a Republican candidate. They're open to it when it comes to economic issues, but they don't like the Republican positions on social issues, and they certainly wouldn't like all this recent talk about birth control and all this kind of thing.
And the final group you described is Starbucks moms and dads, and I guess these would be the suburban moms and dads. We have some pretty interesting counties just outside of Philadelphia where a lot of them live.
Yes, you took the words out of my mouth.
Sorry about that, Linda.
They are more than 50% of all voters now live all over the country, live in suburbs and exurbs. These are the real power voters. And as you mentioned, in suburban Philadelphia, these are the counties, the areas that Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, presuming he's the nominee, will fight hard over. Because, you know, that will make a big difference as to who carries Pennsylvania. And they did go for Barack Obama in 2008, but they're concerned about the economy. And I think they're up for grabs this time.
You know, some people might be scratching their head over the description of NPR Republicans, because I think there's a belief, rightly or wrongly, out there that NPR is a bunch of, you know, socialists who are dragging the country to the left. But you're saying they are NPR Republicans.
Oh, sure. There are plenty of Republicans who, if you put them in a closet, they would admit that they listen to NPR. You know, sure. There are, and you know, this is interesting as it relates to the Tea Party. You know, the Tea Party has made all the noise in the Republican Party, and they have, you know, kind of captured the nomination process by virtue of being loud and turning out. And you saw that in Delaware in 2010 with what happened to Mike Castle, very popular former governor, longtime congressman who ran for the Senate. Was challenged in the Republican primary by the, you know, Christine, I am not a witch O'Donnell, lost the primary, and then the Republicans went down to resounding defeat in the general. My contention is, and the exit polling in the Ohio primary last month, I think, bore this out. I think the Tea Party is only about, Tea Party and Tea Party sympathizers, supporters, are only about a third of the, reflect about a third of the Republican Party. And two-thirds, I think, are more traditional Republicans. But they're not turning out. They're being intimidated by the Tea Partiers.
Well, do you think there's an equivalent group among Democrats, a Democratic, quote-unquote, Tea Party movement?
No, there isn't anything like that, I don't think.
Democrats don't know how to organize themselves very well.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, on the left, I think the left, and as I go around and talk about the swing vote, I get this, I almost inevitably get a question from a liberal, from a progressive, who will stand up and say, but Barack Obama has been so centrist in the way he's governed. He's turned away from the left. How can you not say he's not a centrist? You know, they feel he's swung way over to the center. And he has on things like accepting the Bush tax cuts. But, you know, health and, you know, health reform turned off a lot of people. And even though it kind of didn't do much good in terms of the president's popularity, because progressives were mad that there wasn't single payer, mm-hmm. and other people, moderates, feel that there's not enough cost containment in it. There was just a study today that indicated that it's going to cost money. And so, you know, he knows that the center is where the action is. The Obama campaign is very savvy, and they know that that is where the presidential campaign is going to be won, in the center.
Well, but interestingly, and I don't want to spend the whole hour on the Affordable Care Act, although we could, but it's built around this mandate idea, and that was a Republican conservative idea that came from the 1990s.
Way back when.
Back when, exactly.
But I think the critics, and of course, again, and this goes to the dysfunction of Congress. I think it's actually a good case study. And in the book, in the swing vote, I talk about the dysfunction of Congress and our government, and a lot of independent voters are concerned about that. And, you know, health care reform passed without a single Republican vote. Now, was that because the Republicans just simply refused to cooperate and didn't want to give the Democrats a victory? Some would say yes. Others would say, well, okay, but way at the beginning of health care reform, the Democrats were in charge of both the House and the Senate back then. They kind of told the Republicans to go sit in a corner and be quiet. When it came to in the committee, when Republicans were trying to offer amendments, and, you know, any major, major piece of legislation like that that passes without a single vote on the other side, you know you're going to have trouble. And now we do have trouble. Now we have all these attorney generals going to the Supreme Court and trying to overturn it.
And we're up on a break here, but interestingly, 34 Democrats voted against the Affordable Care Act. So there was some diversity, I guess, on the Democratic side. Let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Linda Killian is our guest today on Radio Time. She's got a brand new book called The Swing Vote, subtitled The Untapped Power of Independence. And if you are one of these people, if we've been talking about you, do give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Delaware Rep supports WHYY and presents Thornton Wilder's Pulitzer Prize-winning comedy, The Skin of Our Teeth, April 19th through May 5th. Called a marriage of Plato and Groucho Marx, the Antrimus family faces one disaster after another, from woolly mammoths to Atlantic City showgirls and end-of-the-world warfare, only to endure and thrive in this timeless tale of human inspiration and survival. For tickets, 302-831-2204 or rep.udel.edu.
The school year is winding down, so maybe the teens in your house are starting to think about a summer job, but does scooping ice cream or stocking shelves build character or resentment?
I worked as a teen. I hated every moment of it.
We'll ask our panel of moms about the pros and cons of summer jobs, plus a big picture take from a researcher who's actually studied the issue. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase Cancer Center and Fox Chase Cancer Center Buckingham have been awarded 3-year terms of accreditation in radiation oncology by the American College of Radiology and the American Society for Radiation Oncology. This accreditation represents Fox Chase's commitment to the high level of quality, patient safety, and technical rigor as specified by national experts in the field. More at foxchase.org and foxchase.org/Buckingham. Fox Chase Cancer Center, hearts plus minds.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Linda Killian. She says about 40% of voters in this country describe themselves as independent. And she says also that about half of them are swing voters, meaning that they could vote for either party or maybe even a third party candidate. She also says in her new book that these voters will probably decide who the next president of the United States will be. And the book is called The Swing Vote, The Untapped Power of Independence. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Linda, as we know, Congress's popularity is pretty much down in the dumps, in the single digits. But do people also have that same sense of frustration and negativity about their individual representative in Congress?
Well, I think for many years it was true that overall people would say Congress is terrible, but my guy or gal, they're pretty good, you know. Now I think it's pretty universal that they not only think Congress is bad, but they don't think their member is that great either. And I think that's what we've seen. We certainly saw that in 2010 with the sort of churning. And even though it was a big swing in a way, the Democrats lost the majority, the Republicans picked up, you know, many seats, still less than 15% of incumbents were defeated in 2010.
Interesting.
And that is part of the frustration. So many congressional districts, and Pennsylvania lost a couple of seats in the redistricting that came after the census. But, you know, so many redistricting is done in back rooms by governors and members of the state legislature. In many states, citizens can't even testify about it. And so many congressional districts are drawn to be safe seats for either Democratic or Republican incumbents that there are, by my count, and some people disagree with me, I think there are only about 50 truly competitive districts in the country that really can swing back and forth and contain an equal number of Democrats and independents. And I believe if we had redistricting reform and there were more districts that were evenly distributed, which of course incumbents don't want, they want safe seats, there would be more moderates in Congress. And when they ran in congressional districts, these members would have to appeal to the center and to independent voters.
In fact, you write about this loss of moderate voices in Congress, and besides redistricting, you talk about the influence of special interest lobbyists, the amount of money that campaigns have to raise, of the fact that in many states it's difficult for independents to actually vote, especially in a primary election. And also you talk about the, as you describe, the partisan, opinion-driven, and shrill media, that all of that is kind of pushed the moderate voices out of the room.
Yes, you captured it perfectly. That is what I say in the swing vote. I'm a big advocate for open primaries. I think independents should be able to participate in primaries. In half the states in the country, they cannot. They cannot vote in primaries. These are elections that they pay for with their tax dollars, and they can't participate. And you've seen in the presidential campaign participation percentage-wise, of course, we don't have a race on the Democratic side, but on the Republican side, percentage-wise, participation is down. There's not that much enthusiasm. And the few states where independents can participate, like New Hampshire and South Carolina, those were early states, admittedly, so excitement was higher then, but participation was up in those states. In New Hampshire, half the voters were independent voters who participated in the New Hampshire primary.
So do you think there are choices that voters have, which is they can pick a candidate and vote for that candidate. They can stay home as well. I mean, do you think we have a system that is designed to keep voters from voting?
Sometimes people ask me about that, and I don't believe that. I think perhaps some people think that incumbents would just prefer that just they turn out their base. And, you know, independent voters are messy. They are, they change their minds, they're unpredictable, and this does scare politicians. But what I think is that they need to make their voices heard. When you represent 40% of all the electorate, that's more than either Democrats or Republicans, you deserve to be heard. And I don't think politicians will listen to these independent swing voters unless they insist that they listen. You know, what I say is the politicians pay lip service to these voters. Obviously, how are they going to vote? Who are they going to vote for, Romney or Obama? Who are they going to vote for Senate or governor in different states? But what I say is the politicians turn their backs on these voters. What I say is it's a little like a one-night stand. You know, they woo their votes in November, and then the minute they get elected, they turn to their core supporters, their base, their fundraisers, and it's a problem.
But do you think that opens the door to a third party or independent / third party candidate?
We will have one in 2012. There's, of course, we're going to have a Libertarian candidate.
Yes.
I actually just did the Dylan Radigan show last Monday with the candidate who is running for independent, the former governor of New Mexico. But we also have a group called Americans Elect,
yes,
which has raised $35 million and has a goal of getting on the ballot in all 50 states. I think they will be on the ballot in 40-plus, for sure, at least. And they have an online process. It's AmericansElect.org. Not that I'm endorsing it. I'm just explaining. And any registered voter can participate. And right now, Buddy Romer, the former governor of Louisiana, is sort of the sort of most well-known candidate who has said he is seeking their nomination. Other people like John Huntsman have been mentioned, but he said he won't do it. They could get a fairly, you know, it's not inconceivable mm-hmm. that they could get 10% of the vote, and that could have unintended consequences. It's not clear who those votes would come from.
Well, I was curious about whether you think that would represent this moderate vote that we've been talking about, or whether it would be attractive to people on different ends of the political spectrum.
I think it would be. I think there are a lot of people who are fed up. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when I talk about the centrists in my book, because I think they are the real swing voters, and inevitably, when I do public appearances, I also get questions from libertarians
sure.
and from far left progressive people who say, we're fed up too. So it's not just centrists who are independent voters. And, you know, Pennsylvania's voting history has been, I was in preparation for this. In 1996, Ross Perot got 11% of the vote in Pennsylvania. That's higher than his national total. In 1992, Ross Perot got 19% of the vote nationally. That's very significant, the highest percentage since Teddy Roosevelt ran in the Bull Moose Party. And I contend that 20% is sloshing around and looking for a home and willing to make a protest vote to get politicians' attention.
And I do want to get to our callers, but do you think candidates know this and are trying to figure out how to appeal to these voters?
Yes, I do think it will certainly depend it remains to be seen who the candidate for Americans Elect will be. Buddy Romer, one of his big issues is money in politics and the deficit. Ross Perot, of course, the deficit was his big issue. And I've heard Bill Clinton say that Ross Perot changed the national debate and had a big impact mm. on the later Congresses and the fact that the deficit was front and center and the budget was balanced. So I think a third-party candidate, an independent candidate, could affect if they get polling, they can participate in the debates, and I think they could have an impact on the discussion.
Do you think Ross Perot helped Bill Clinton win the White House?
Well, you know, everybody is divided on this, who Ross Perot took votes from, and I think the most accurate polling indicates that he took some votes from everybody. So I think the feeling that he just took votes from Republicans is not accurate.
And that's Linda Killian, our guest today on Radio Time. She's written a new book called The Swing Vote, The Untapped Power of Independence, and it's our topic for today's Radio Times. She's a journalist and senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and writes for a wide variety of publications. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Matt from Havertown to join us. And Matt, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I think an important point here is the fact that we really don't have a choice. Honestly believe that you know, the choice has already been made for us. It's like when my child was 3 years old and he wanted some independence, and I would put out two outfits for him and made him believe like he was actually choosing something. So it's the same difference here. They're putting these candidates in front of us. We don't have a choice. The third-party candidates, I'm a registered libertarian and have been for years.
But you do have a choice,
man. On election day, I go in and pull the libertarian lever, and I walk out, you know, because I think that's, you know, that's what I should be doing. But unfortunately, the media and all the other factors involved don't allow us to even explore those other choices, and it just gives us those two choices that nobody wants to make. It's unfortunate.
Well, that's an interesting comment, Linda, and that gets us to the media. And do you agree with Matt that the media has kind of forced some of these more third-party candidates, or in Matt's case, libertarians, sort of out of the room so that there's no discussion about what these people stand for?
Well, I think his point is that even if he does vote for a libertarian or if he does vote for a third-party candidate, they have no shot at winning, I think is his point. And, again, he's saying he has no say in the primaries right. to decide who these two parties will put forward. So it's a problem.
Yeah.
And that's why I say that the independent voters, people like him, have to express their frustration and tell the two parties they're fed up and they want more access, they want more of a say in who the candidates are.
And, Matt, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, but, Linda, do you think that the parties would open up the primary process to allow Matt to, you know, have more of a say in when he goes to vote?
Not willingly.
Of course.
I mean, you know, why would the two parties have kind of a stranglehold on the political system? And, you know, I quote in my book, I have at the beginning of every chapter different quotes
yes.
from sort of founding fathers and from... I begin the book with Thomas Paine and end the book with Thomas Paine because common sense was a call to arms for the common man. And I hope in some way that the swing vote will be the same thing. But I quote George Washington, who says, "I was no party man myself, and the first wish of my heart was, if parties did exist, to reconcile them." So I don't think the founders intended a two-party system like this. There's no reason why it has to be this way.
Right.
And that's why I'm saying if voters made their voices heard. In many states have, and California has done this, many states have a ballot, you know, you can do ballot initiatives, and voters can put forth ballot initiatives. And they did that in California, and they have... they had a redistricting commission made up of citizens, Democrats, Republicans, and independents that drew the congressional districts in, I think, a much fairer way. We'll see the outcome here for the first time in 2012. They also adopted a top two system where all voters can vote and the top two candidates move on to the general election. I have some concern about that system in a big state like California, because libertarians, for example, at least now you can collect signatures and be guaranteed that you will have a libertarian candidate on the ballot. But in a big, expensive state like California, that might preclude a libertarian making it to the top two.
Interesting. Let me see what looks like Scott from Center Valley has to say. And Scott, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
What I just wanted to add to this was, you know, talk about the Electoral College. Because it seems to me that there's no way to get past the two-party system lock on the elections if they have to, you know, a candidate has to get a certain amount of electoral votes. In the last bunch of elections that, you know, seen in my lifetime, you know, it's the presidential election has been decided first and foremost by electoral votes. You know, decided even before the popular vote is fully counted.
Well, Scott, let me give Linda Killian a chance to weigh in on that. Thanks for the call. And Linda, go ahead.
This is also a question that I frequently get. Whenever I do media with call-in or whenever I do public appearances, people ask about the Electoral College. And, you know, really the only way to abolish it would be through a constitutional amendment. But, you know, there is a question about not having someone elected with a majority of the popular vote. And there are some efforts out there to abolish the Electoral College. And, you know, I was thinking recently of Andrew Jackson, who, you know, won the popular vote, our former president, and was defeated in by Congress-selected John Quincy Adams over Jackson, who had won the popular vote, and he became a real advocate of the voice of the people and the people's voices should be heard, and came back, of course, to win the presidency. But, you know, this is a concern, and just like with campaign finance reform, it's the same kind of thing. It almost would take a constitutional amendment to change the way campaigns are financed, because the Supreme Court has ruled that money is speech, that corporations can raise and give money to candidates. And, you know, it seems that, as with the Electoral College, the only way to deal with that is through a constitutional amendment.
But I'm also thinking, have we created a political system that is, in a sense, incapable of dealing with the serious problems we face? Whether you support the Affordable Care Act or not, we nonetheless have a health care system that we probably cannot afford. We have highways that are crumbling. We've got to figure out about debt, income inequality. Do you have any confidence in a minute or less, Linda, that we have a system that can actually get down to work and deal with these problems?
Yes, I do have a lot of concerns about that, and I think a lot of Americans have concerns about that. I think you see that in the abysmal rating for Congress and the approval rating. I think you see that in the frustration. To some extent, when you asked about voter turnout, I think sometimes people vote by staying home and expressing their frustration because they're so fed up. And because, like our first caller, they feel they have no choice. I think the deficit, some recent polling has indicated that the issue, you know, the most recent Washington Post poll has shown that Barack Obama, voters say he's more likable and more trustworthy than Mitt Romney, but the one issue that Mitt Romney is very competitive on is the economy and the deficit. And I think this is an issue that voters feel has not been addressed by Congress and the president in the past 4 years. And one reason is it's a tough issue, and we've had many times for them to deal with it. We had the deficit commission. We had the raising the debt ceiling. We had the super committee. And time again, Congress cannot act on important issues like that.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Linda Killian, author of The Swing Vote, The Untapped Power of Independence, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
Montgomery School supports WHYY, an independent day school for boys and girls in pre-K through 8th grade in Chester Springs. Montgomery encourages each child's natural curiosity and passion for learning while helping to lay the building blocks for lifelong success. To learn more about the opportunities that Montgomery has to offer its students, there is an admissions information session and tour on April 13th. Details at 610-827-7222 or montgomeryschool.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Tensions between the U.S. and Iran are at a high point, but mountaineers from both countries are scaling heights together, there and here. Also, a new novel tells the story of a character who'd be happy hanging out with Holden Caulfield and Nick Carraway. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY Bosch Thermotechnology, manufacturer of geothermal heat pumps that use the constant temperature of the earth to heat and cool homes. More information at boschgeo.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Linda Killian about swing voters. She's a Washington-based journalist and a senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Ed from Yardley to join our conversation. Ed, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I feel that in my area and many other suburban areas, people tend to focus on one or two issues. There seems to be a very low level of knowledgeability about the political system or the political stands of parties and individuals at all. In the local paper, people just key on one or two particular issues such as taxes and health care, and very few people I talk to have a broader view of what the real issues are. And I notice this very much in our local school board. Everything is just based upon taxes. They don't look at a broader perspective. And in my area, very much, I tend to sense that they don't read papers like the New York Times, but will read local papers that present issues at a very basic level.
Well, Ed, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Linda, he's wondering whether voters are informed enough to make the decisions we've been talking about.
Well, I mean, I think I'll tell you, the voters, I did, in doing the swing vote, I traveled all over the country. I called up voters on the phone and said, you're an unenrolled voter in Ohio or Colorado or New Hampshire. Would you be willing to talk with me? Most of them were. And what I found was, and I did focus groups, I attended public events and campaign events in 2010. I think this is another, along with the sort of myth that there are not that many swing voters, I think another myth is that they're totally uninformed mm-hmm. and that they don't care and don't pay attention. I reject that idea because I think certainly there are people who are busy with their lives and taking their kids to soccer practice and working two jobs and just trying to keep up. But I found a lot of voters that cared a great deal and were very well informed. That were independents, but who just have become so frustrated that it's kind of like, well, like our first caller, what can I do?
Sure.
You know, they just feel so frustrated that sometimes they do tune out. And from my perspective, is it the chicken or the egg? Are they not that interested and that's why the system isn't that good? Or have they become so frustrated because the system is so bad?
And we're almost out of time here, Linda. Do you think then these swing voters, as we have been talking about, that they will, in the end, define and decide who the next president of the United States will be?
I have no doubt that they will. In what the media call the battleground states, Ohio is certainly one of them. Pennsylvania has not voted for a Republican since 1988. Mm-hmm. So if Pennsylvania is in play this time, you know it's going to be a close election. But I have no doubt that the swing voters are going to decide who the next president is. And what my hope is in writing the swing vote, and what I hope if and in people reading it, they will see other people that think like they do around the country. They'll hear their stories. And I hope they will do more than just turn out and vote. I hope they will get active and try to change the system.
Well, Linda Killian, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. She's a journalist, senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and the author of this new book called The Swing Vote, The Untapped Power of Independence. Lieutenant Robert Neary and firefighter Daniel Sweeney died yesterday fighting a fire in an abandoned warehouse in the Kensington section of Philadelphia. The five-alarm fire was declared under control early Monday morning when a wall collapsed in a store next door to the building, killing Neary and Sweeney. Three other firefighters were injured. We asked Everett Gillison to join us today on Radio Times in this final portion of the first hour of the show. He's deputy mayor for public safety. And Everett Gillison, a sad day in Philadelphia.
Yes, it is. Thank you very much for having me on.
You're very welcome.
But it is a sad day. We lost two real heroes doing the thing that they love to do and also keeping us safe. And I just continue to ask for, as the mayor does, ask the Philadelphians to keep the families and also the department and the city in prayer.
Do you know, does anyone know the cause of this fire?
No, not yet. The fire marshal has the grounds and will continue to, once it is safe, to go on the grounds and to do their investigation. They will put together the facts and present them. But as of right now, no, we do not still have a cause for the fire.
And we're talking about a large abandoned warehouse.
Yes, although abandoned, I still have to tell people there was an active owner who was part of this matter. They had sought to convert this warehouse into condominiums. Whether or not that had anything to do with this, we'll find out. But it wasn't abandoned. That we don't know what was going on, but it was a vacant warehouse. That's correct.
Owned, as you said, by two men in New York. They owed the city $60,000 in back taxes, something like $12,000 in bills to the city. How were they able to get away with that?
Well, the process is that once we find out that a person doesn't give us what they have, we go after them. And quite frankly, the city had gone after them to the point of we had scheduled and we're scheduling a court hearing to go in to take the property by way of sheriff's sale. So, you know, if you go into arrears, the mayor made it clear a couple of years ago that he wanted the L&I process to be more responsive and consistent with those procedures. When they didn't pay, they ended up going in, and we were about to seek to foreclose on this for sheriff sales and for the back taxes due.
In fact, since November, L&I had cited the owners something like four times for violations.
That's correct. Every the people in the neighborhood. Coincidentally, this has become a Philly Rising neighborhood. One of the other initiatives we have in the city. We were working with the people out there. They ended up bringing complaints about the matter. L&I sent an inspector out after 6 days. A complaint was made on October 31st, and by November 8th, we had already been out there, cited them, and had contacted the owner to get some action. A 30-day period is required under the process and by law, so we ended up waiting 30 days to see what he would do. We did that three successive times, so that takes you until 90 to almost 120 days to have them correct the actions that were done. And when that wasn't done, we were moving to take them to court on that issue for not cleaning and maintaining the site the way they're supposed to.
But you're really talking about individuals who are thumbing their nose at the city in defiance of city regulations.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you think about it, as the mayor said, just very simply, we can go out, we can cite, but it is the personal responsibility of every landowner, every person in the city to take and maintain their properties. We come after you when you don't. But we have to follow a process. If you want to help and do what you need to do, all you have to do is correct the situation. It's their responsibility. It's their professional matter in real estate that they're in that business. Well, part of that profession is to maintain their places safely, and quite frankly, we had cited them for not doing so.
And do they own other buildings in Philadelphia that you know of?
They do. We've done an analysis. They have approximately 34 properties, we understand, that we've traced to various corporations that are associated, we believe, with this matter. And they own about 34, and there's
there's a lot of money that's owed to the city on those other properties as well.
Are you considering, is the city considering criminal charges against these owners?
We have, once we have gotten the information from the fire marshal and a cause is established, I am sure that I'll be sitting down with the district attorney. The mayor's asked me to sit down with them and to see exactly if we can bring criminal charges or not. That's ultimately up to the district attorney, but we will turn over our facts as we find them.
And my understanding is that lawyers for these owners are going to be in the city today?
Yes, they are scheduled to meet with representatives from the city and the managing director's office at some point today. I will be called when they're in just to see exactly what the status of those talks and what fruit comes of it.
Now, my understanding is, and as you said, there were four LNI citations for violations. Reading the papers today and listening to the radio, neighbors had been complaining about squatters, vandals, the dangerous conditions in these particular buildings. And one can understand the frustration of people living in these neighborhoods.
Well, absolutely. But I said, we found those conditions. We cited those conditions. We have found, and I also want to tell people that the enormity of the problem that we have in Philadelphia is that as far as vacant buildings, we have close to 20,000 plus in the city, and we are moving to try to get those buildings handled by the owners, and I think this kind of thing kind of should serve as a harbinger to owners that when you don't do what needs to be done, very bad things can happen. And we're hoping that people will heed this warning and work with us as we seek to clean this mess up.
Are you talking carrot sticks, a combination of the two?
I think that we try as much with the process, which I think gives enough carrots. I think we have to start looking at additional sticks. The mayor wants us to look at, right now, license and inspection can... even if we cite a building and once we go to court, it could take anywhere between 6 months and a year to get into and then deal with that. And then we can actually only fine a person up to $300 per day for every violation. That may not be enough because, quite frankly, we've seen owners ignore even after going through all of that. Then they'll just say, well, I'm just going to walk away and the city can take the building. The city is not a real estate agent. We are a city of a government that's trying to provide services for people that people need. So we need to figure out different ways of getting the stick to have maybe a little bit more teeth in it in order to go forward.
Do you think there are owners that can't afford these repairs? And do you know anything about the finances of the owners in New York of this particular building?
I don't have any personal knowledge of their matters. I know that there were some media reports of the fact that, like everyone else, the economic collapse affected everyone's. I know it affected the city's resources. I'm sure it affected this property. But quite frankly, they still have a personal responsibility, like all of us, to maintain safety for all who come in contact with us. And quite frankly, even if they had nothing, they should have made sure that the building was safe and secure.
Fire Commissioner Lloyd Ayers is, I guess, going to be speaking with firefighters today. What is the city going to be doing to help these firefighters through this difficult time?
Well, we have, unfortunately, we have had several in public safety. Since being deputy mayor for public safety, I've had to deal with over five police officer deaths. We have established a protocol. We have put in not only EAP, but supplemental EAP, which is employee assistance programs, to deal with not only the mental health needs, but the physical needs of the people. The fire department is a great family orientation. We have a great organization with all of our public safety folks coming together. We will be with the persons who are fallen. We will be with their families. And that's why I think the mayor has always maintained that we need to always say, yes, we have an issue that we're dealing with this warehouse, but let's keep the focus, as we mourn, on the firefighters who have lost their lives, keep the focus on supporting the families and making sure that we take the steps that's needed to keep going and correct the situation that obviously has been brewing for quite some time.
And how are Neary's and Sweeney's families dealing with this tragic loss?
Well, I think that like everyone else, we all mourn in our own ways, and grief will consume. But you know, my faith tells me that even though there is darkness before the dawn will come, and we just have to make sure that we're there to help them as they approach their new dawn.
And Robert Neary had been with the fire department for a number of years now.
Yes, the lieutenant had been there, I think, close to 37 years.
Wow.
I was looking at his date of appointment and was marveling that he started in the fire department when I had graduated from high school. So it was a long and distinguished career. He had received several commendations, saving people's lives, and quite frankly, Mr. Sweeney, our firefighter Sweeney, even though he'd only been on for 5 years, had already saved a number of people's lives. So, you know, these public service is a calling. I know that, you know, that people will say, well, we can never pay enough, we can never do enough, we can never... You get into this business because you are called to serve, and these men, quite frankly, are the epitome of those persons who are called to serve, and we honor them. Not only with our hearts and our minds, but we also honor them with our actions. And our actions in this will be to support these men and their families as they go forward.
Well, Everett Gillison, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. A very sad day in Philadelphia. In fact, flags are at half staff today. Thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Everett Gillison is the Deputy Mayor for Public Safety, joined us to talk about the fact that yesterday two firefighters died while fighting a fire in the Kensington section of Philadelphia. And their deaths and this fire has raised a whole host of questions about abandoned properties and the responsibility of owners, especially when there have been so many violations against this particular property. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.